All right, this is the QTR podcast number 7, and it's a very special podcast because I got my ass up out of bed at 7:30 in the morning on Saturday, and it's Saturday. Is it St. Patrick's Day? It is St. Patrick's Day, actually. After
the greatest day in the history of any culture.
You know, you're supposed to let me introduce you first before you interrupt me, you know? I'm fine with you interrupting me. I'm used to you interrupting me, but you have to at least let me introduce you. You could be anybody. I could have Bob Dole on the phone, and people would be like, people would not know right now.
I'm an editor. What do you want?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Well, anyways, so on the horn with me today, I have the one, the only, George Moriarty, who is editor extraordinaire for Seeking Alpha. I don't know what your actual title is. I was going to look it up, but like our little test call we were supposed to have before we started, I just decided to just start, and I figured the sooner we get started, the better. So why don't you introduce yourself so I can mainline some coffee here and give us a little bit of background as to what you do.
Top of the morning. Yes, this is George Moriarty. Thanks very much for having me on. I'm excited to talk to you. I am my official title is executive editor and vice president of content for Seeking Alpha. I think most anyone who knows QTR knows Seeking Alpha because you and I have been working together for many years, and you're one of the Seeking Alpha success stories, somebody who came on board. Beauty of the crowdsource model, came on board, started sharing your ideas, developing your writing style and voice. You got some good ideas out there. You learned some along the way in a public forum.
Got some bad ideas out there.
Yeah, I was going to gloss over that, you know, spirit of the day and all.
Now let's go for the jugular today.
we love you. Stories like yours are great. I mean, we're happy to have many institutions and large, well-known names on the site. But, you know, guys like you who came on board, started from scratch and built themselves up. That is why I work at Seeking Alpha. You know, by way of just a little bit of background as to what I've done before, I started up in journalism back in 97 at a Thompson publication that was an old printed newsletter covering private equity. We, a bunch of 20-year-old guys and women, sent out printed papers about stuff we really had no explanation about and were paid exorbitant amounts for it.
Like the Gartman letter.
Quite similar.
Did you send it to retail people, or was it for like institutions?
These were institutions. It was private equity and VCs. Okay. We were out in front of salespeople, limited partners, people who were investing in these private equity vehicles, pension plans, all that. So our source list was deep. It was invaluable to me as a first job because it wasn't just kind of cold calling everyone. There was some help because part of the point of those industry papers at the time was when someone nailed a big deal, this was how they would let their peers know that they got one, right, and what they were in on.
So this was before the internet was super mainstream.
This was super old school trade rag mainstream. We were publishing once a week, got news. If we had breaking news, that meant that we found out about it on Thursday afternoon, whipped out a story as quick as we could, because deadline was Thursday night at, if I recall correctly, midnight.
Okay.
And then it landed on people's desks on Monday morning.
Oh, wow. What year was this?
This is 20 years ago. Like, just to put in perspective, this isn't like, I'm not 75 years old. I'm 47. 85? That's how much things have changed. For the record, I'm 47.
So this was like mid-90s.
Yeah, I started in 97. I covered the VC and internet boom from the VC perspective from 97 to 2001.
I feel like in the late 90s, though, I was just starting high school, and I feel like we had I feel like the internet was a thing, though. I feel like, you know,
I mean,
it was Netscape Navigator, but
it was Prodigy. It was, yeah. I mean, it was Netscape. It was. I'm losing my old school bona fides because I can't remember the one that starts with a G that was the first monster IPO. But we covered all of those.
A G.
I mean, there were so many.
What was it?
You're just going to embarrass me because I'm not going to remember until Tuesday.
Well, that's why I have you on, to embarrass you. No, was it an internet service or was it a?
It was, yeah. It was a global GeoCities. That was it.
Oh, GeoCities. Yeah, the websites. Oh, those fucking things, with the flashing text, and there was always some little like animated, you know, man. Everybody had the same one on their, you know, when HTML first came out, that was the big deal. Like if you could make the title of your page, which was in regular text, flash, you know, that was just. You know, and then you open the flash tag and forgot to close it, so you would log onto somebody's website and the whole fucking thing would be blinking back and forth like a traffic light.
Yeah, like you had to get warnings if there was anyone who suffered epilepsy, they couldn't use the internet at that time.
it was a sad, sad time in our history.
But like the amazing thing is at the corporate level, like the internet was really just getting started. I mean, Thompson, I built the first website for those publications, and it was like a front page with links. There, you know, they were just getting into it because they weren't sure about the investment.
Right, right.
You know, and then the stories and the way money was being thrown around at those companies was just crazy. You know, there were the days of, you know, 1 week was pet related online companies were getting like up $200 million in funding or something, and you know. My favorite story was two wine delivery companies were competing. They both started around the same time. For all I know, they were neighbors who didn't like each other, and this was their way of having a debate.
Right.
And one of the guys, and this is really the first time I taught me to be skeptical of why people were doing things in business, because I was young, I was learning. And this guy, one company had raised $12 million. And same day I got a release from the other company that they had raised 14. I said, well, why'd you raise 14? What are you doing with it? He said, oh, well, I just raised 14 because my competitor had raised 12. So I needed to raise more than them.
There you go.
And I'm like, that's, you're saying this on the record. Like I confirmed that I could quote him on that.
Yeah. That's like the housing crisis. You would go and apply for a mortgage, you know, like for a commercial loan of $1 million. And Lehman Brothers would be like, here's five, you know? Okay.
You don't need $1 million.
Right.
Why are you being so cautious?
We'll tell you what you need.
Yeah, please. Dilute your investors just because you want to be bigger, theoretically.
So let me ask you a question. In the late 90s, because I certainly wasn't investing then yet. I think I like jumped in at like 2001 or 2002 and did horribly when I was like 18 years old. But In the late 90s, when you guys were doing research for this newsletter, what was the procedure like for getting SEC filings? Because it probably wasn't, you know, they probably weren't as ubiquitous as they are now. You probably can't just log on and get them. Did you have to, like, mail away for them?
Particularly for ours. So some of them were available on Edgar. Edgar had started, but they didn't have everything on there. Like, you could get private placement memorandums. You could get, you know, S1s and all, and the standards, but these forms for the private equity filings, we actually had a guy whose job was to sit in a basement room in Washington, D.C. And I didn't believe it. Like I thought, okay, fine. Like,
right.
He's overstating it to try to get himself a raise or something.
Right.
I went down and met him. He was literally in a windowless room in the SEC and he poured through these paper filings for funding rounds. And just pulled out stuff that was interesting and would write stuff up and send it up to us.
Like Milton, like, from Office Space.
It was unbelievable. I mean,
we're going to need you to move down to storage B.
Could you get buried in SEC filings if that would be okay?
Yeah, that sounds hideous.
But he did it for years. He did it really well. And I'll never forget one time he found this story and sapped it up. I don't even know if you remember space.com.
Vaguely.
Lou Dobbs was one of the founders of it. And he sent this filing up, and I'm fascinated by space. Like, just, you know, I understand none of it.
Right.
But I've always been fascinated. And so the guy flagged this thing, and I was like, hey, send me the filing. I want to follow up on that and do a feature on space.com. You know, what are they going to do? So I call over, and I get a call all out of nowhere. I left a voicemail, and I assumed I wasn't getting anything back. I pick up the phone, and I hear Lou Dobbs' voice, you know, which I was used to hearing coming over CNN at the time. Mm-hmm. This is Lou Dobbs. How did you find out about our money? And I was like, whoa. And because he couldn't believe that we had somebody sifting through the papers.
Right,
he thought
he
could do it. He thought he could just slide it under.
Right.
And it shouldn't make it sound nefarious. Like, you know, it's just the way it worked. But he was just like...
But he was Lou Dobbs.
Right. He had raised money from Venrock Associates, which was the Rockefeller family's VC fund.
Okay.
And, like, I have to say, for leaving current politics out of it, given what he has become in the media today, like, he could not have been nicer. He introduced me and made let me speak to every one of his investors. He gave me 2 or 3 follow-ups to make sure I had the story right. Like, he was phenomenal to a young, dumb reporter who stumbled across something, and the only reason he followed up is because he thought the moon was neat.
Right, right. It's, you know what, it's really cool when you meet somebody like that who, you know, they're a media personality, so you're not really sure how they're going to, you know. This summer I met John Najarian for the first time, and I don't know if you've ever met him in person, but I met him out in Vegas, and I had no clue what to think. I had been introduced to a CNBC anchor who will remain nameless, and some years back at the Sohn conference, and I went up to this guy and I was like, hey, how are you? You know, my name's Chris, I'm Quote the Raven. And he walked past me, he was like, thanks for watching, you know? I'm like, I don't even fucking watch your show. Like, fuck you. And he just walked right past me. So when I was introduced to John Najarian, I was kind of like, well, you know, I wonder if all these on-air types are you know, the same. And he could not have been a nicer dude. As a matter of fact, I'm still, like, a little taken back by it. Just a solid all-around guy. And, you know, was drinking beer with us, hanging out with the whole group. And just, you know, it's nice when you meet somebody like that and they haven't let all of their popularity go to their head, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's, you know, and that kind of ties into the next step in my career is I wound up next at thestreet.com from 2001 to 2008. And that was really amazing. Like, you couldn't, I think Josh Brown has referred to thestreet.com as the Motown of financial media.
Right.
And so I was in the second group. There was, the first group was led by Dave Kansas.
When were they founded, The Street?
1996.
Okay. And when did they go public?
1999 or 2000.
Okay.
So
what was that like?
Well, I wasn't there when they went public. I joined after they went public and after they had actually started, they'd had a big cutback. They had, after going public, they opened a London office, all that. So I joined. Dave Morrow was the new editor in chief. And we started building up subscription business. That's what I was hired to do at the time.
Okay.
But walking into that place, you know, you're sitting there with some of the best reporters who are out there writing for either the Real Money site or for the free site. So right. That's how I met Herb Greenberg.
Cool.
That's how I started working with Adam Feuerstein. You know, so those two stick out to me because they're great reporters who teach you how to report and who do it in such a smart way. You know, they're skeptical by nature. But watching the way, I think one of the things that they taught me is everybody assumes that guys like that who report those short bias stories are always going to be pushing, oh, whatever conspiracy theory comes around about a corporation they're going to do. It's like, I think if people realize just how many bad ideas good reporters pass away, that might go with their
right.
perceived perspective.
Right.
They would be astonished. Like the number of bad ideas and watching, you know, you think that they're only skeptical from the long side, but when you watch someone break down a story and say, yeah, you know what, there's just nothing there.
Right.
You know, even though it, you know, everybody sometimes wants there to be something there because you're seeing something that just looks and smells bad, but good reporters don't run out with that stuff. Right. Good reporters approach everything skeptically. If you got somebody come flying in, I'm going to blow this company up. I've got the smoking gun. Like, those guys do a better job vetting that stuff than anyone gets credit for. And they leave a lot of stuff on the sidelines. And I think that's what people don't really understand is that the quality of reporting that goes into a negative article is incredibly in depth because
it has to be.
You get killed whenever you get a story wrong. I mean, you know, being public with your investment ideas, like, you know, people want to pick on you for anything that goes against you, but they don't talk about the stuff that you got right. Well, so everybody will hammer those negative stories. So you got to be sure you have a story nailed if you're going to go public with it.
Right. And I don't think either that people understand journalism and, you know, specifically when you talk about guys like Herb and you talk about guys like Adam who, you know, are not afraid to kind of be skeptics and go after companies with, you know, I've seen Adam be positive on a number of companies. I've seen Herb be positive on a number of companies, but there are also, you know, I would say probably most financial reporting is, 80 or 90% on, you know, with a long bias and probably 10% with a short bias, if you want to kind of describe it like that. And guys like Herb and Adam, I think, are more like 50-50. And,
right.
You know, not only is it really refreshing to somebody who's involved and somebody who's interested in, you know, public companies from both the long and the short perspective, but I don't think that a lot of investors and a lot of people who are sitting at home trading in their E-Trade accounts understand not only how, you know, how these stories have to be vetted, but what the, you know, what journalistic procedure is. I mean, I sure didn't some years back. I mean, I graduated college with a degree in English. You know, I didn't have a degree in journalism, but when I started to write on Seeking Alpha and you guys started to offer me feedback on articles that I was writing was the first time I ever started to get a tiny taste into what the journalistic process is. And then over the next couple of years, as I continued to read more articles and I occasionally would bring an idea to a journalist and try to pitch them something or see if it's something they would be interested in speaking to somebody on, then you really start to get a look into how rigorous their process is. There's an old school reporter at Barron's that I've befriended over the last couple of years who he has to be older. I don't know much about him. I know his name. I don't want to say it publicly, but I have a feeling this guy is just an old... he sounds like, when I talk to him, he's been doing this for 40 years. And he sounds like the type of guy that still takes notes with a little pad and a little pen that he's got in his pocket. And you get on the phone with this guy, and, you know, he doesn't really email. He'll call you if he wants to get in touch with you. And you get on the phone with him, and it's just like, hey, you know, hello. You know, hi, how are you? Good, what do you got for me? You know, we've been looking at a company that's, yeah, whatever, you know, send me your notes, put as many facts down as you can and send it to me. I gotta go, you know, it's like, so from that, you know, you start to get a little bit of a feel as to how rigorous the process is, because, you know, there's very little margin for error, especially when you're looking at a company skeptically. But when you do it right, like, I forget the guy's name, but the guy at the Wall Street Journal that just did Theranos. I mean, that's what reporting is all about, right? Mm-hmm. That's what investigative reporting is all about. So what was it like working with Herb? He was one of the first people that reached out to me when I first started writing. I think he sent me an email and I gave him my phone number and he called me one day. He was like, this is probably in 2011 or something. He was like, who are you? I said, I don't know. I'm just a guy wandering around Philadelphia, actually. I said to him, he was like, he had called me and I was like, I was probably in between bars or something in Center City. And I was getting ready to hop on the subway. He's like, who are you? Like, do you work for a hedge fund? I'm like, I work at a bar. Like, and I have to go because I'm getting on the subway. You know, right. Who are you? What was it like working with him? He's been a super nice guy over the last couple of years that I've talked to him.
Yeah. I don't know if Herb's going to hear this or not, but he's a lot nicer now than he was when I started working with him.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, you can tell he still has a little bit of, he still has a little grit to him.
He tells the stories and he's not lying when he says, like, you know, if you were editing something and chat, like he was out in San Diego and I was on the East Coast. And part of my job when I started working at the street was we had this service called Street View that went out at 7 a.m. for hedge funds. It was very very high priced model. So I was getting up, waking up in Westchester County, getting to the street's offices at like 6 a.m. and get in order to get that thing out. And then Herb's out in San Diego. So I would then, you know, grab a train home, be getting to my house around 5 o'clock. And that's when I would get the call from Herb about whatever story he was working on for the next day.
Right.
And so like, if I would ask him questions or whatever, he'd be like, it's fine. It makes sense. Don't question me. Just publish it. And I mean, most of the time he was right. So, you know, he was right, but you know, it was, he was very funny, but you know, when you got used to the approach and knew what you were getting and watched how he did the job, watched how he validated all this stuff, you saw, like, you know what, it teaches you a lot. And I've actually every now and then, probably once a year or so, I'll get in front of a class of kids in my area and talk to them about, you know, how journalism works. To your point, people don't understand it. So like, I'm trying to contribute the little bit I can and teach these kids how to actually read the paper and understand what's going on behind the scenes. And they, and I used something he used in a presentation back in 2004. I still use some of those ideas for people to understand how it all works and what happens, because he knows how to do it. Cause I mean, he talked about old school. I mean, he was a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, back before, you know, he went to the street. So, I mean, he's seen it all and he's adapted.
Right.
And he has, I think that's part of it, but like he was amazing as long as you were, you understood what you were getting.
Right. Right.
You know, he would be very enthusiastic when he had a great story. He would, you know, he was very, proprietary about his words, even if they were misspelled and, grammatically challenged. But the facts were always there. And so that was, as a fairly young editor at the time, you know, it was one of those things that he absolutely taught me how to be a better editor. And he and I have gotten back in touch thanks to the miracle of modern internet and, you know, just, you know, picking ideas off here and there. Hey, this guy's got a question about something that you guys ran. You know, he is probably the best journalist, the best financial journalist we're going to see for some time. I'm sure there are people out there doing just as good work. I mean, Charlie Grant's awesome. Obviously, I mentioned Adam. Meg Terrell seems really solid. Like, there are other people out there, so I don't want to say, like, he's the last of a breed or whatever. But, you know, the chance to work with him was invaluable.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. And like I was saying, I think you can still, you know, I guess as a journalist, and I know I call myself probably a blogger or an amateur journalist, but when I'm working on something, you know, it's a race to get to the facts. It's a race to get to those terminus points that like can't be disputed. And those are kind of the points that you have to use to build your case or build your article or whatever. And so, you know, when I just spoke with Herb a couple of days ago, we were just having like a postmortem on Herbalife. And I can even tell just by the way he conducts the proceedings when we're having an informal phone call that he wants to get to what we want to say, and then he wants to get the hell off the phone. You know, he's not, yeah, there's not a lot of room there to talk about the weather, which I think is great. You know, if the whole world functioned like that, we would be a lot more efficient and have a lot less wasted time. But
and you know, that you just reminded me of a great point about what the depth of reporting that good reporters do. You know, everyone assumes, oh, talk to the company, talk to this person, talk to that person. Like, take, these are the sources you can get. And the Herbalife story reminded me, because a couple people that he was talking to who were not regular writers or analysts or journalists were trying to figure out a way to get, like, you know, they knew we had the conversation around Herbalife on Seeking Alpha. And like, good reporters don't just talk to companies and analysts. Right. He introduced me to a former attorney general in Wisconsin, I believe, who has written for us several times. He prosecuted Amway, and he's an expert on the legal issues around MLM.
What's his name?
He introduced me to that's Bruce Craig.
Oh, Bruce Craig. Yeah, I've read his stuff.
And he introduced me to Bill Keep, who's the dean of a business school over – Bill actually lives right near me. But he's the dean of business school at the College of New Jersey, and he's an academic expert on the matter.
So yep. He just published
yesterday,
too.
That's the depth of reporting that people get into. Like, good reporters
– Okay, sorry. Yeah, lost you there for a second. Sorry, you were saying?
So, yeah, I was just talking about the depth of reporting that people do, you know, that you're not just listening to companies and research analysts and people within Wall Street. Good reporters are going out there and finding that academic and legal expertise and people off the streets. Like, you know, so you're talking about Herb again, like he's running his private research company now. And when you look at his tweets, like people probably think, like, why would he be looking for a dentist? It's like, I don't know where he's going with it, but right. If he's looking for a dentist, that's because he wants to understand from the ground up.
Right.
You know, whatever he's looking at, a dentist has insight into his process.
Right.
And into this story he's analyzing to see if it's valuable. And people should pay attention to that level of research, because so much in the year of the tweet is, you know, hey, this stock looks like crap, man, and, you know, throw it out there. Absent any depth of research. And I think that's part of why people are willing to pay for stuff that they see has more credibility than others.
And what's really fascinating is when you're on the outside looking in, you know, probably 6, 7, 8 years ago when I was just dipping my toes into the capital markets, and people that trade on their own or people that are still getting their introduction to how the whole system works, what you expect going in, you expect that the sell side are going to be the companies that are doing the type of research that guys like Herb do. From the outside looking in, when Goldman Sachs puts a buy rating on something and you're like John Q. Public sitting at the dinner table and you own stock in a company that they slap a buy rating on, and maybe even get a you know, some color on their analysis from like a little blurb from The Fly or from Seeking Alpha or whatever, you're thinking to yourself, at least I was, you know, great, this is the guy that knows the company cold, this is the guy that has done that type of research. If it's a medical firm, he's gone and he's talked to the doctors and he's, you know, looked at the ins and the outs of the business and he understands the way that revenue is recognized and all the shit that I don't understand, you know, this analyst gets it and he's vetted all these things and so he's placed a buy rating on it. And then when you start to understand actually how the system works, you're like, whoa, you know, like Goldman Sachs comes out and upgrades Tesla stock right after they do an equity raise with them. I forget what it was. It was before or after, but it was within 24 hours of doing the equity raise with them. Or you look at, you know, Goldman Sachs comes in and downgrades gold and a day later they're upgrading it. They're bullish on it. Or, you know, you start to notice that the underwriters of companies – private financings also happen to be the investment banks that all have buys on the stock. So you have a small cap stock that nobody's ever heard of, and, you know, Maxim and Roth and Chardin come out with buy ratings on the stock and price targets that are 200% higher than where the stock is, and all of a sudden the company goes out and raises money and those are the three underwriters, and, you know, JP Morgan not participating, Wells Fargo not participating. And you start to notice these things and you're like, shit, man, like it can't actually be that rigged, can it? And you start to just watch this happen over and over again. You're like, oh my God, like this is perverse. This is insane. It is like a giant con. And so the research that guys like Herb do, and for biotechs, when you read Adam's stuff,
right,
is so desperately needed, because it's really the real research. And that's what's so cool about Seeking Alpha. You know, Seeking Alpha is filling in this huge gap that all these boners on the sell side are either told by their bosses to, you know, ignore, well, just don't talk about that, or they don't have the depth or the perspective to ask the right questions or to be critical on the company, or they want to maintain their investment banking relationship with the company or whatever it is.
And yeah, and part of it too is, you know, as much as you raise appropriately, you know, the issues of conflict, whatever, the other issue is just the model is broken, because with the, you know, all of the changes that have happened to sell side about fee-based and everything else, you know, the biggest issue is research desks are very small. People are trying to cover way too many companies.
Right.
They can only have one view on a stock. Like, I'm sure you've heard it, but David Jackson founded Seeking Alpha because he, when he was working at Morgan Stanley, you know, he was frustrated by the fact that he couldn't have discussion outside of his coverage universe professionally. Right. And he started an email list of people who were just kind of batting around stock ideas. And then, you know, and then somebody came back and like, this is awesome, but it's too much, you know, kind of perhaps apocryphal, but it's like, you know, put this on a website so I can have it all there. And like that's how Seeking Alpha was born, as a crowdsourced model from people who didn't have the outlet otherwise. And that's where we've, I think to an extent, have disrupted and continue to look to disrupt, is the fact of the matter, when you get that, no matter how legitimate the shop, you know, if you had the world's most pure research shop out there covering stocks, a research sell side analyst isn't going to present you both sides of the case terribly often.
Right.
You know, they are going to say, okay, here's why we like it, here's why we don't. You know, what we try really hard to do at Seeking Alpha is say, here is the bull case for the stock, here is the bear case for the stock, and then find some experts to come in and fill in the middle.
Right.
And, you know, in a way, I guess this is part of the somewhat sadistic mindset it takes to be an editor and journalist, is, you know, it's a really good day for me if I get yelled at by both sides.
Right. Right.
Like, that means we've done it right. If I get some if I get a good flame email from somebody on both sides of a debate, it's like, okay, that's what Seeking Alpha is supposed to be, because we don't want to be wholly endorsed and we don't want to be giving just one voice.
What do those flame emails look like? I need some salacious content for my podcast. What are some of the more creative flame emails you've gotten?
I mean,
exclude ones from me.
You know, just I'm personally, again, career choice is going to say this. I like clear, concise critiques.
Right.
So, you know, some of my favorites are when you see an email come in from Seeking Alpha sucks at hushmail.com. And so, you know, they're really interested in engaging in conversation, right? And they say, you know, fuck you, please die, you know, just lots of succinct points that question my parentage and anything that we're doing.
The worst part is when it comes from an email like that too, you just you know, you hope that maybe the email address, as you see it first before you read the content of the email, is not going to be indicative of the content, you know? You
say, there is, well, a very direct correlation, my friend.
Maybe this guy used to hate us, you know, when he made the email address, but he's writing to tell us all of the things we're doing right now.
Yeah, you know, delete my account, you know, all those things. You know, so there's just so much, and it really is, you know, I know there's an account that you tweet out a lot. You know, Bagholder Quotes exists for a reason. It's the market creates a ton of opportunity for it.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Bagholder Quotes is a genius. he's like one of my favorite people in general, like just market related and just a good friend and a funny ass dude. And he is, he loves it. I mean, he basks in it, and that account is one of the best things that's ever happened to financial Twitter.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, we've got you know, but that's the way it works, and that's when our model is actually working, is, you know, we also get a lot of people who write in. You know, it's funnier to talk about the people, you know, asking if I was fathered by goats or whatever, but it's we get lots of good commentary in there too, from people saying, hey, this was great, thanks for helping me discover this, thanks for, you know,
right,
that article alerted me to an opportunity that I hadn't seen. And, you know, we get a ton of that. And the other thing we do is we keep our comment streams open. As you know, a lot of places are shutting down comments.
Right.
And when, you know, we've kept it open and we have an active moderation team that's working virtually 24/7, and we get, I want to say, you know, thousands of comments a day, but we have human beings. So
it's got to be more than that.
Somebody comes in and responds to something, you know, there's a human being reviewing whether it's an actually bad quote, bad comment, or if it's just somebody who's being oversensitive because they disagree with it.
I think the comments are really important too. I'm sorry to cut you off, but like the comments are really important because so many times when I'm reading on a company, the analysis doesn't stop with the article, you know, and many times too, when I used to write a lot, I would always be anxious to see the comments because that's where you're going to find out if you missed something. That's where you're going to find out if you got something wrong. And so some of the best analysis happens in the discussion in the comments.
Yeah, 1,000%. It's, you know, I've often had people come in and say, hey, I do a lot of research on my articles, but I get more out of the feedback from my readers than I do from my own individual research. And the authors that engage in those comments, that deliver that incredible value to people by saying, hey, this is it, and pull it in. You know, Chris DeMuth is actually a genius at this. He is so good at the conversation with his readers that he just pulls it out and builds it. And that is Seeking Alpha in a nutshell. And, you know, we can't do everything. You know, there's trolls are going to slip in and try to upset these comment threads, but the comments are so valuable. Like that Purdue study that we featured a few years back, like a big part of that was not just learning from the articles that were posted, but from the attitude and comments. You know, what were people in the comment threads saying?
Right. Yeah, so. I don't know how Chris DeMuth does it. I think he's married. I met him once in person, and I think he has a family because
he does.
He was telling me, you know, his wife was criticizing him for how long he was spending working, but the amount of content that he produces. I mean, he runs money, obviously. I think he's got a partner, that guy Andrew, who I met once also, is a nice guy. He does
very nice, very smart.
He does a podcast, and then when you look at his, you go on his Seeking Alpha profile, it's like boom, you know, 24,568 comments, 15,226 articles, and just like, holy shit, like, where does this guy find the time? I mean, the amount of content he generates, and it's not filler either, because occasionally I've clicked through, you know, when I see his article, I'll be like, man, Kristen Mew's in the top 10 again, like, you know, this guy's just got to be leaning on his keyboard and submitting things. And 5 minutes later, I'm like, holy shit, that's a great idea. You know, he did this whole speech. I was with him at some conference somewhere, and
it was the MicroCap in Philly.
I think that's what it was, actually. That was a couple years ago. How'd you know that?
I'm a smart guy. I also talk to my contributors.
Oh. Ooh.
Very in-depth secret of journalism revealed right there.
So, you know, he's a merger and arbitrage guy, right, too. I don't know if he has a background in it, but certainly that's something that he specializes in. And he gave an hour-long presentation about methods for collecting all of these little, like, life arbitrages that exist. He was like, you know, I forget what it was, but it was something to the effect of, like, I switched my newspaper subscription from every day to, you know, every other day because I'm saving 33%, but content-wise, I'm still getting all the things that matter because I get the, you know, I get the Friday paper, and that's where most of the content is, and I opened a checking account at a bank across the street from my other bank because they were offering $5 if you deposited $1,000. So I deposited $1,000, I took the $5, I waited for the 60-day lockup to end, and then I withdrew my $1,005, you know, and it went down this list of, like, little like referrals for websites and like, you know, it was just, you know, like people do like professional couponing. Like, yep. That's kind of what he was doing just with everything in life. You know, I haven't paid for a cup of coffee in 30 years, you know, just going through all these different little tricks and life hacks. And I'm like, holy shit, like, that's got to be exhausting. But when you read analysis, investment analysis from somebody, like, that's the shit you want. Because if you can find a loophole and it's not, here's a free $5 on opening $1,000 in a checking account, it's something where there's some liquidity and you can make 5% and it's basically a guarantee and you can put your whole portfolio into it. Then those are the times you really want to like mash the gas and get into it. So the way that he thinks, you could just tell he's a very gifted thinker. He's a different type of thinker. And I'm sure that was making him a very successful investor. And
you know who else is really great at that sort of common sense, you know, hey, wake up and don't be stupid about handling your money, is Roger Nussbaum, who's like, I mean, Roger's like one of the grandfathers of blogging.
Who is that?
So he is a financial advisor out in Arizona. He runs Random Roger's Blogspot. He's on, not Blogspot, just Random Roger. But he's on Seeking Alpha. I'm going to pull it up while we're talking, but I mean, he's been on Seeking Alpha since 2000, since the start, really. Okay. He's got somewhere on the order of 80,000 followers.
Oh my God.
Just because he's been around, like, and I would almost bet you that if you went back, not once has he said buy XYZ because it's going to make you $1 million. He's just like, hey, here, you're trying to manage your portfolio. And so his latest articles are alternative substitutes for equities. Game planning another lost decade. It was a bad week for volatility. Harry Markowitz's portfolio. Like, if you want to just be smart,
right,
and approach things in a common sense fashion, like, poke around and find people who are like you. You know, similarly, if you want to find, you know, these stock tippers, that's fine. Go for it. But, like, there's so much opportunity lost in that chase versus people who are trying to actually just help you be smart so that you have a few bucks when you're 90.
Right. Yeah. Put your shoes on and then tie them, you know? Like, right. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. Like, what's the old John Wooden advice? Make sure you don't have any wrinkles in your socks when you pull them on, because that way you're not going to affect your gait. Like, right. It's just a simple thing.
Yeah, that's it. It's just, you know, blocking and tackling, as my old boss up in Canada would say. He was an old Southern guy. Cool. Everything was a football analogy with this guy. Of course, the business went to zero, so it's, I don't know if there's any correlation there, but
so he didn't protect his blind side?
No. We're just blocking and tackling, you know, just basic air day, just come on in and just everybody do their job, you know, or run the ball right up the middle. I'm like, I'm starting to suspect you don't know anything about business at all, you know? You know, a lot of football analogies, a lot of golf analogies, you know. We're going to tee off here. I'm like, are we actually playing golf? And you keep talking about it this way.
Did he wear his high school letter jacket around the office?
By no, chance? But honestly, he wore his fucking class ring. Like, I think from, and he didn't go to, like, it wasn't like he went to Duke or something. He went to some like local college down south, and he wore his class ring. I don't know, like Jostens style, like those. Look, I don't care if you are a class ring guy or not, but like, I find them like personally, like, just odious. I don't like the way they look. I don't like the concept of having a class ring. Maybe that's just me. I don't wear rings, whatever. But you know, to be like 50 and still be wearing your college class ring or high school or whatever it was, because he was state champs in, you know, 1979, you know, set the record for most yards rushing. I'm like, dude, have you ever used Microsoft Word? You know, I don't use that shit. You know, a pen and a pad does just fine for me. So
this coming from a guy who's ornamented most of his visible skin is pretty compelling.
Oh yeah, I know. And if you actually knew the stories behind a lot of my tattoos, and it would be much worse. I mean, there's not too many like fantastic stories. There's a lot of stories that you tell after, you know, six or seven beers, and you just move closer to the guy next to you at the bar, and you just say, hey, you just whisper, hey, you want to hear a fucking crazy story? Let me tell you about this one here. You know, one of the really cool things, just to circle back on Seeking Alpha and circle back on all the different types of analysis, and you know, I think the cool thing about the concept of Seeking Alpha, and by the way, I'm not kissing your ass because you're doing the podcast. Like, you know, amongst ourselves, when we speak, you know that I'm a huge fan of the website. I'm a huge fan of what you guys have done. I'm super appreciative of what you guys have done for me and helped me disseminate, you know, my name and my research. And I guess in a bit, I'll tell you a little bit about kind of how Seeking Alpha has connected me with a lot of people. But when you talk about the crowdsourcing model, you know, I always think of it kind of like Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia is fantastic because you, and it has generated a ton of content and a ton of information because it has this model where everybody with all these different viewpoints is allowed to kind of have their say. And I think what winds up happening in these types of like wiki sites and these open source sites is, yes, you get some people that come in and fuck around with things and try to mess things up, like just like you guys deal with paid promoters and people with nefarious intention. And I'm sure Wikipedia is the same way. You know, when something in current events happens, somebody always goes in and makes some smart-ass comment on their Wikipedia page first before the moderators get to it. But what you also find happening is you find people that are experts in all of these crazy, weird, little, like, esoteric niches of, you know, any number of fields. You have guys that are, you know, astrophysicists that go on there and they just can't help themselves. They have to make sure that the article on the Higgs boson is written correctly. And you have guys that are, you know, geologists that go on there and they, you know, absolutely can't help themselves. They need to make sure that, you know, the difference between sand erosion and water erosion is explained properly and is differentiated. See, what happens is it winds up attracting people that are like experts in all these crazy little back end niches of, you know, just general information. And ultimately it produces this giant wealth of useful information that most of the time is going to be fairly accurate and fairly resourceful. And I look at Seeking Alpha the same way, because you have, you know, all these experts from different, you know, guys like Bill Keep. I mean, Bill Keep's not an investor. I mean, he may invest on his own, but, you know, Bill Keep is an academic. He's the dean of a business school. You know, he was an expert witness for the SEC on pyramid schemes. So he has this really tiny little niche that he's like super, super specialist at. And, you know, he's not in there weighing in on fucking biotech stocks. He's in there talking about what he knows about. And so the cool thing about the site is it's kind of got this gravity to it where people that are like experts in their fields kind of just tend to move towards, you know, what they're good at and talk about it. And that's what makes the content of the site so powerful. That's what I think makes the model so powerful. But the really cool thing is, to just to circle back to the sell side, is Seeking Alpha can no longer be ignored. So when I first started writing for Seeking Alpha, I don't know when it was, but it was probably like 6 years ago or something, there were a lot of times where you would produce something and you would wait for the sell side to put together their next bit of analysis, and you'd wonder why they hadn't acknowledged you know, what looked like material information that had been published to Seeking Alpha, or analysis that drew different conclusions, but profoundly different conclusions that were credible. And now I feel like, George, I feel like this site can't be ignored. I feel like if you're an analyst covering a stock, especially if it's a smaller cap stock or a mid cap stock that doesn't get a lot of love on CNBC and doesn't get a ton of analyst coverage, you know, if you're one of four guys covering a $500 million market cap company, and, you know, some 19-year-old freshman in an econ program at Rutgers goes on and publishes an article about that company and draws conclusions that nobody's drawn yet because he's just looking at things differently, they have to pay attention to that, because that's how strong your base has gotten and how powerful your dissemination has gotten.
Yeah, and the one thing I want to make clear is, you know, Wiki and other outlets like that, we're not pure open source. You know, we have, anyone can contribute an article, but we have humans that review anything that goes out for syndication. Like, we do not, and that's how we, I think it's really important that people understand that, because some people think like, oh, we're just throwing stuff up. I can throw it on Seeking Alpha and see how it sticks.
Right.
You know, we've got editors who at this point are my current staff, and we just hired one guy. So reduced the experience for him to being 1 week. I mean, we're still averaging 5 years of average financial journalism experience. We've got three CFAs on the team. So we know how to look at this and make sure it's valid and relevant analysis, and it keep making things better. And that human element protects us from the stuff that happens on Wikipedia and whatnot. Like, you can't throw something up and have some troll come in and hammer you before or whatever. Like, you know, we've got somebody who's going to come in and check it. And we're not perfect. And that's where it cycles back to that crowdsourcing. The key of the crowdsourcing is not just that anybody can write something, but that those commenters can come in and say, hey, you misrepresented their cash flow.
Right.
You're using non-GAAP numbers on this level of your analysis, but then you skip over to GAAP because it fits your narrative better. Like, who are you trying to fool? You got to call right. that out. And that's the value of having those humans in place. And I think that's really what separates us and puts us in that conversation, like you said, is it's not a bunch of, you know, back to the thing, my first job, like, it's not a bunch of 20-year-olds who don't really even understand how a venture capital fund works,
right.
trying to report on it. It's, you know, we have people who have been in the industry in one way or another for a long time. And that's how we're hopefully continuing to bring those quality people on.
No, your editors are badass. They are, first off, I've learned a lot from your editors. I mean, I've learned from you because over the, you know, years, as we've gone back and forth on a couple articles that I've wanted to publish, and I've had feedback, and sometimes I'll ask you personally about things and pester you. I'm trying to do that less. But your editors are really badass. So, like, you look at a guy like Mike Taylor, okay? This is a guy that, first off, he's a stickler for getting it right. You can just tell by the feedback you get, all right? So the guy's a CFA. He's extremely intelligent. You can tell by the feedback that he offers. And, you know, Mike's a guy who, after you have some submissions reviewed by him 3, 4, 5, 6 times, and you see that he's starting to ask you for the same thing. Like, did you talk to the company? Did you run this by the company? Did you bring your concerns to the company? Have you reached out to IR? You know, all of a sudden you start to be like, well, maybe I should start reaching out to IR before I submit this. And I can, you know, if they don't pick up, I can put a line that says I reached out to the company and they weren't available. Or, you know, a lot of times they'll pick up and you can say, I spoke to IR and here's what they said, or I reached out to the company and they provided no comment. But little things like that, the whole, you know, the whole process of working with your editors, for me personally, has made me a better analyst. And I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. Like, this is basically how I've learned to kind of shape a good part of the way that I analyze companies. Are because of guys like Mike. And you submit an article and it gets through and you're like, cool, it's published, I said what I wanted to say, whatever. Other times you get this huge list of things back in the feedback and you're just like, holy shit, you know, like, here's 24 things I just wanted to see if you could address before we publish. But ultimately, you know, that speaks to the job that you guys do in trying to make sure that the content that goes out is as accurate and as reliable as possible. And at the end of the day, it sucks when you have to go back and make the changes, but obviously you want your work to be accurate, number one. And number two, it makes you a better writer. It makes you a better investor. Like, something stupid, George, like putting the lead first, okay, which is something I never used to do. I used to always, when I would write about, you know, something that happened a couple months ago, or hey, the last time that I talked about this company, I said this, this, and this. And I just remember one email after another from you saying put the lead first. What's the point of your article? You know, that needs to be in the first paragraph. I didn't even know what a lead was. I was like L-E-D-E, like Lede, like, I mean, I knew fuck all about journalism. I knew nothing about writing. You know, again, like I was saying earlier, I certainly didn't understand how the journalistic process works. But things like that, you know, so now when you write, oh, sorry, I get a little feedback there. Now when you write, you know, it's like the lead always goes first. And also I know what a lead is, which is great. So it's been really educational. It's been really awesome. And your editors do a badass job. They do a really good job. For how big's the staff there?
So, I mean, across the whole content team, we've got about 40 people. And that's between the O&A team, who you work with, the news team, our content QA team, and our pro team.
How many articles do you guys go through a day? How many do you publish a day?
We publish between 250 and 300 most days. Of the stuff that's submitted, we generally publish at about a 75% to 80% rate from existing contributors.
Okay.
So, you know, like you said, guys who have worked with us and know what we're looking for.
Right.
Can contribute in a way that is more effective and efficient. We work really hard with new contributors. You know, a first-time contributor's rate is like 10%. So, you know, we draw the line. Like, we're trying to coach them up and bring them along so that they know how to submit at the right level of analysis so that they can get to that higher 80% rate and keep pushing those ideas forward.
Well,
and it shows... And those 200... Yeah, and I just... And it, sorry, just quickly.
No,
the news
go ahead.
Team also is... The news team is also a separate item from those 250 to 300 they put out. You know, during earnings season, the news team puts out like over 500 pieces a day of those, you know, short form news items. That's a lot of our data team capturing quick and getting earnings reports out quickly. But then we also have a big U.S. team on the news side who looks at it and curates the news flow from Twitter and all the other sources and PR Newswire and whatnot to, you know, because nobody really cares about some bank opening a new branch, but everybody cares when the CFO resigns and making sure that they get they curate that flow so people know what they're getting and what's happening in the news that's relevant to their investments.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the really cool things, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, my buddy Kubiko has said this publicly, and I have as well, that, you know, Yahoo really fucked up by not buying you guys when they went to revamp their Yahoo Finance site, which, you know, that revamp was horrible. I actually just heard Google did one too, and I heard theirs was pretty atrocious too. I saw some negative feedback on Twitter. When you guys left the Yahoo partnership, you know, I had only been a contributor, I think, for like 2 years or maybe a year and a half. And I remember you actually called me when you guys were leaving Yahoo or when you were considering leaving Yahoo. And I was at my apartment in Philadelphia. I remember the day I was sitting outside by the pool, like doing nothing. And similar to like when Herb Greenberg called me, you know, probably on my way to a bar or something. And I remember you just called me out of nowhere and you were like, hey, you know, we're thinking about leaving Yahoo, and I just wanted to, I'm trying to get some contributors' opinions on, you know, do you think the site can kind of go it alone, or do you, you know, how much do you think we should rely on them? And first off, I was like, what is this guy asking me for? Like, I was baffled. I was like,
no, I remember it. And I think you're flattering us that happened very quickly, with Yahoo, you know. They came to us, and what we were doing was we were trying to figure out, because we knew, and we had actually been working aggressively, like the whole Yahoo thing was fascinating, because when I started at Seeking Alpha, like the Yahoo pogo stick reader, who's given us tons of page views but not quality,
right?
Meaning like they were just coming in, reading, bouncing back to Yahoo, and didn't even know they had been on Seeking Alpha.
Right.
Like that user is useless to any website. We had started shifting away, trying to shift away from Yahoo dependency, because we're like, all it takes is them to wake up one day in a bad mood, and we could be in real trouble here.
Right. Yep.
And that was a decision that was made before I joined, but we were pushing it, and we had shifted our dependency on Yahoo. They were still a big traffic driver, but you know, they then, without getting into all the specifics, they came to us and said, "Hey, you know, this is going on." And we were like, okay, that's a problem for us, you know, but fine. You know, we'd been preparing for that day through our email alerts and stuff.
Right.
And so what I think I remember calling you about was trying to figure out how we balance the compensation so that, you know, we pay for exclusive content. If you publish everywhere, you don't get a dime, but it's got to be exclusive to us.
Right. That's what it was.
And that was, we were very quickly trying to understand, you know, what was a meaningful structure for that wouldn't bankrupt us, to, you know, make sure that contributors still got the value out of it. And that was, we were calling up, we reached out to a bunch of people just to get that feedback. And whether or not I knew you'd be available because the bars weren't open yet or not, we were just reaching out to people who we knew we could get quick, honest feedback from. Because we had to move quickly, because what Yahoo did, you know, in whatever went on behind it, you know, they launched their erstwhile effort on Tumblr like the next day after our partnership broke. So, you know, it's pretty clear why they decided that we weren't going to be their friends anymore.
And how's that working out for them?
I think you should reach out to Marissa Meyer to get her feedback.
Oh, yeah. I have a couple things I'd like to speak with her about. That would be very low on the list. I would have a few things to talk about first. But I was just taken back by the fact that you had reached out for contributors' opinion.
Yeah, it's important to us. We don't exist without contributors. We really don't. Like, I mean, we have a bunch of numbers that we throw out around there, but we've had over 16,000 people contribute to the site at one point or another. We have active contributors, meaning they've written an article over the past 6 months, is somewhere around 2,100. And you know, some of those people write once every 6 months, some people write three times a day.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing, is we you've been in our contributor forums, you know, we try to be as transparent and open with people as possible about what we're doing, and to make it the place that, you know, to continue to be the premier place for crowdsourced content.
I've always,
like, it's hugely important to us to hear from them. Like, I never do anything without trying to think, okay, what does this mean for our contributors?
Well, it shows too. I mean, it shows in the fact that you're kind of the destination for people like myself that want to go and they want to contribute somewhere. But I never got the impression from you guys that you didn't have the contributor's best interest in mind, since as long as I've known you, really. And that's like something that's very easy to say from you guys. We love our contributors. Without our contributors, the site is nothing. You know, like, it's very easy to come up with a line like that and just say, you know, we value our contributors' opinion, you know, and then not listen to anything they have to say. And I'm sure you guys could do well and you know, probably not as well, but you could still exist and have that attitude. But I have a pretty good nose for bullshit, and over the last 6 or 7 years, or as long as I've known you, and the many things we've worked on, and the many times we've spoken to each other, and again, with all the feedback I've had with your editors, and the calls that I've had with you, I've never got the impression from you guys that you were, I always got the impression from you guys that you really have the contributor's best interest at heart. Even like when you do something and you go and you change, you know, the pay structure for contributors, or if you're going to make structural changes to the website, these are things that always wind up getting bounced by the contributors. You really feel like you're a part of the site.
It's funny. You reminded me, I was reading an article last night about the Toys R Us debacle. And what you're saying just reminded me of a quote in there. Somebody said, so our target audience is mommies and babies, and I walked into this conference room that was filled with old men in suits.
Right.
Like, if we try to run a website for independent investment research, how do we not talk to independent analysts?
Sure.
I mean, I don't want to go the way of Toys R Us. I've got four kids who like food and want to go to college, so I need us to keep working here. So again,
so
they really like food.
So going forward, what, you know, obviously everybody, and by everybody I mean me, and wants to know if you guys are going to go public. I mean, what are your plans for the site going forward?
I could never speak to that even if I knew. I mean, I'll tell you, in this, you know, if you want to put on, you know, the corporate spin alert siren or whatever, you know, I don't know what our intentions are right now. I can tell you we had our board meeting this week, and our intention and our short, intermediate, and long-term goal is to keep growing Seeking Alpha on every metric that matters to us, and that's revenue, that's ad sales, that's quality contribution, that's number of people participating in the comment streams. Whatever the exit is, you know, we are sort of a traditional startup. We're all investors in the company we work at.
Sure.
But we're not focused on what the exit is. We're focused on making a really great product, and we've got a smart board and great leadership in Ellie Hoffman and David and Alon Zeev, and those guys handle the financial stuff. I want to make sure the words keep bringing people back, and that's what I'm focused at, because if they start consulting me on corporate financial strategy, that'll be a red flag.
I know that I've petitioned you for this privately, but I just want to get it on the record now, you know, that if you guys do wind up going public, I think a great idea would be to somehow, you know, include in a very small, you know, some include the people that have contributed to the site to participate somehow in the IPO, or participate in, you know, I think that would be such a cool idea. I think it would fit into your kind of contributors. It doesn't have to be anything crazy, you know, you don't have to give 10% of the company to your contributors, nothing like that.
But just a random number.
Yeah, right? You just pick a number. No, but it's something to like an extremely small degree, you know, maybe you take a quarter of a percent of the IPO or something, and you somehow introduce the contributors to that, or you get at least give them the option maybe to buy into it or something. I think that would fit into kind of like your contributors first mindset. And also, you know, I'm just greedy. I mean, it's an IPO I would love to be a part of, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I honestly have you've raised that before, like, you know, could we become investors? Could we, you know, because we do compensate
right
authors who contribute to us, like, hey, what if I wanted to convert my earnings, like keep the cash, give me shares in the company? The structure of that gets wicked, wicked, wicked complicated. And yes, that's a triple wicked from a guy who grew up in Massachusetts, so you know it's serious.
Right.
Because if you get too many shareholders, it affects report when you're still private, it affects reporting requirements, you
know, oh yeah,
increases costs and all that stuff. So there's a million things. I mean, I don't know, given that we don't know what our exit's going to be, you know, I think that that's putting the cart, not even on the horse. It's like putting the cart on a paved road without wheels. And the horse is still back on the farm country. We can't even get close to discussing that stuff in private, and certainly not in public.
All right. Well, that doesn't mean I'm going to stop suggesting it to you. I'm probably going on 3 years now suggesting that to you. So I'm just going to continue to suggest that, and you can just continue to politely tell me to go throw rocks. And that'll be fine. You know, that's part of the dynamic that we've established here over the last couple of years together. So I guess one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about is, well, actually, you know what? Do you have time? Are you short on time or what? Look, I know it's 9 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. Do you have a minute?
Yeah, I got at least another 15.
Oh, okay. All right. So
if somebody wants to listen to my nasally voice that long, that's another thing. But
why don't you run me, because we kind of got sidetracked a little bit, but run me from how you got from the street to, well, I guess I have a few more questions, man. Like, tell me what it was like working with Adam, number one, and then tell me kind of how you got from the street to Seeking Alpha.
So Adam was great. Adam is, you know, where he was just so excited when he got a story. Like he was, he would come to his editor, and I edited him directly for a little while. But then I was always a resource for him too, if somebody else was editing him. And like when he gets a story, he gets so excited. It's like, imagine when you see, like, go on Facebook and look up like 6-year-old on Christmas. Cause he just comes up. He's like, this is so great. I've got this story. This is, oh my God, I can't believe this. And he's just like running through the story. And it's like, you learn to figure out, okay, so he's vetting. In addition to being really excited, I've got to listen really closely to make sure he's actually got the story.
Right.
But he's like, his enthusiasm for his work is infectious. And he comes across, you know, on social media as sort of, you know, an exceptionally surly guy and Kurt and everything else. But when he is working, when you're in an office with him, it's just, he truly is infectious because he's just bouncing off the walls. He really values the process of journalism and he loves his work. You know, that doesn't mean that you don't occasionally get in spats with him, because when he thinks he's right, he really thinks he's right.
Right.
But he is just somebody who you can't help but respect the enthusiasm and effort they put into their work product every day. And he's really good at reporting. I mean, he knows how to sort it out. He knows how to flip it around. And one thing that I do remember him doing, and this is something that people don't see, is he was always looking for talented reporters. And, you know, when I first started at the Street and I was talking to Herb, Herb's like, yeah, that Adam Feuerstein guy is really good. And at this point, Adam was out in San Francisco, so I knew he existed on the site, but like, given my work, I hadn't really read him much.
Right.
And then 5 years later, I hired a couple reporters, and Adam's like, oh, that girl's great. You should let me work with her. I want to help her develop. She knows how to do it. You know, I can think of a couple people who he did that. Liz Trotta and Lauren LaCapra. And Lauren LaCapra is now like financials editor at Reuters or something. I mean, she's really rocketed it up. I'm not sure what Liz is doing, but I certainly endorse Liz because I hired her twice. and that's the thing that you see about people too, is there's not that proprietary keep people out of my way. You know, when you see some reporters kind of want to elbow out anyone else who comes in at them. I think some of these guys were very receptive and encouraging of reporters who are coming in and starting to figure stuff out and wanted to work with them.
And he's a nice guy too, Adam. I've spoken to him. I mean, he's another Boston guy, right? So you guys have that little bond.
He happens to live in Boston, right? Presently. We are both bald and we're both, as you might say, undersized. But he is a Boston transplant. He is a New York guy.
Oh, is he? He was born in New York?
He's a Yankee fan, which was, you know, I may or may not have spiked a couple stories just because of that.
Right.
Go Red Sox. And he does live there now and has for a few years, but his home and his heart is San Francisco. Like, okay. Seeing that guy, I got to work with him and meeting him out and going to travel out to San Francisco. Like, if you see people who are sometimes just meant to be in a city.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he's phenomenal.
There's a lot of really smart fund managers out in San Francisco too. San Francisco surprised me as kind of being an area that you wouldn't normally think of for the financial industry. I mean, you kind of think New York. I mean, you can think San Francisco for startup companies and things like that, but yeah. Made a couple of trips out there over the last couple of years. There's a hedge fund out there that throws a little event every year. So I've gone and I was surprised at how many quality reporters and quality money managers and hedge funds there are in San Francisco. This is the last place on earth that you would expect, but it's a beautiful city. So
the last place on earth I'd personally expect to find some really top-notch analysis is Skipack, Pennsylvania. But, you know, that's just me.
Yeah, I know. There's not much going on in Skipack, with the exception of my soiree with the secret agent a couple months ago. And that was probably the most excitement Skipack's going to see for a long time. So how did you wind up going from the Street to Seeking Alpha?
So after this beat, I actually went to Merrill Lynch. Complete change of pace, but Merrill had, you know, everything cycles back to the internet bubble, right? Like Merrill had built its wealth management platform website in 1999, and it was this gray, ugly thing. And so they decided in 2007, early 2008, that it was time needed to do a complete rebuild of the platform for their wealth management clients.
And okay.
Just if you don't know the inside baseball terms on Merrill Lynch, like the wealth management, that's the thundering herd, the financial advisors, all the rich people who have their money with Merrill. And so I got to walk into Merrill Lynch, and we did a complete rebuild of this site. And it is probably one of the coolest things I've accomplished professionally. Because literally when I walked in the door, the website was nothing more than wireframes on a whiteboard. And we were working in a conference room off that abutted the garage. And our MD had an office, but pretty much we had a room for the business analysts and programmers and stuff. And then we had a room for, you know, myself and my peers on the management team. And it was like, you know, card tables, computers. Like if I needed to talk to Paul, who was running the show, like I leaned my head around the computer. Very much not the traditional corporate atmosphere you would expect from Merrill Lynch.
Right.
And you know, and we often joked that that year we worked as hard as I've ever worked professionally that year, and we delivered the login page, not without some drama, but when we delivered. Like 3 months after we delivered the login page, they actually gave us real offices.
Okay, beautiful.
In an insulated spot of the building. But so then I was working, and it was really cool. We were building it up, and you know, working with the peers. I mean, that was phenomenal. You know, it was a little dicey going through the implosion and subsequent acquisition by B of A. You know, because I picked my family up and moved them down here from Pennsylvania.
So that's where you were during the financial crisis?
Yeah.
And what was that like? Yeah, what was the mood there?
It was awful. It was, I mean, we were literally like every week you would look out every Friday around noon, you'd look out and see another set of people walking out because they were the latest round of cuts. People were, you know, it was really bad. But I think one of the things I took away from that and that I've applied as a manager going forward is I walked in and said to my boss, like, what do we do? And he just said, we work. Keep doing what we're doing. You know, nobody's told us to stop working. You know, we can sit here and fret and do all this stuff, but we have a very clear job and a very clear expectation of what we need to deliver. So do your job and move forward. And keep working. And we did, and we delivered the website, and you know, all the people there continued to succeed. And I think that's an important thing whenever you're going through kind of a tough time at a job, in the markets, whatever. You know, stick to what you're doing. Don't try to change your stripes to accommodate a situation. But then, you know, after a while, I kind of missed journalism. I kind of missed, you know, producing, like being in the flow. I found myself, you know, I can go read the news now. It's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, see what's going on. It's like, I missed that juice. And a friend of mine introduced me to someone that Seeking Alpha was looking for people. And I wasn't actively looking. Like I was, you know, things were fine. And I met with Ellie Hoffman, and he and I just hit it off right from the start. And then one of the things that really convinced me I wanted to go to work for Seeking Alpha was I had a meeting with the chief operating officer at the time. And he, like, you know, you walk in, it's a second or third interview at this point. I'm kind of like thinking it's a formality. Oh, he wants me to meet with his peers. Like, I was prepared, obviously, but I was kind of like, it's going to be a walk in the park. He challenged me so hard in that interview to justify the stuff I was saying, like, hey, what about this? It was Avram Gilbert, and it always stood out at me because I'm like, this is a company I want to work for because nothing's taken for granted, and they're going to challenge you and make you think and do better. And that's a great environment to work in.
Oh, that's awesome. And now you've been there for how long?
Been there 6 years.
That's and what was it? Did you start? You didn't start as executive editor, right? Or you recently no, I you started, got promoted, right?
Yeah, I started as managing editor for the what we call internally opinion analysis. You know, the submitted articles, contributor content. And that was for about, I did that for about 4 years, and then Ellie became CEO and I was promoted to executive editor, about 2 years ago now, 18 months, 2 years.
Oh, one of the things, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No. And, so that was that. So I've always worked on the contributor content directly. And that's, you know, one of the things that I think is most important for us, but you know, we're doing a lot of cool stuff in the other areas now too.
One of the things that has baffled me that I'm kind of in awe of is that, you know, over the course of the last 6 years or 7 years that we've known each other, you know, there's been times when I've been active on the site, times that I haven't been active, but every time I've reached out to you with something, and a lot of times it's not related to anything I've written on the site. You know, we talk about conferences, we talk about what's going on in the financial news, and actually I think once or twice you've even just called me just to say, hey, we haven't talked to you in 2 months or 3 months. But one of the things that I really appreciate, you know, aside from the power of the platform and the platform being able to get contributors out there, is that, you know, I know that you're dealing with hundreds, if not thousands, of contributors, and there hasn't been a time where I've reached out to you about something. I mean, I try to be respectful with your time. I know you're a busy person. I try to be respectful with everybody's time, but there hasn't been a time that I've reached out to you that, you know, you've told me it's not happening or I'm just too busy, or and I know you're busy because I know you're a family man. I know, I think, you know, we're friends on Facebook, so I could see you're like the Clark Griswold, man. You're doing it all. I see you on vacation, you're at the soccer game, you know, you're like with the kids, you're walking the dog. And there's never been a time where I've sent you a text or something at you know, 7 in the morning or 7 at night where, you know, you haven't at least said, yeah, look, we'll catch up on Tuesday, or I'll block off 15 minutes for you or whatever. And that's been something that, you know, I've noticed and has kept me personally coming back to the site, and also has kept me as an advocate for the site, because, you know, I'll go out and I'll sing your praises, not just because of what the site has done in terms of getting my name out there, but because, again, you guys do have this contributor first kind of mindset, and you live it. You're not just saying it. I mean, it's the real deal. Like, you're really interested in the success of your contributors. And I think, I don't know if you remember, but when I think it was like 2014, but I was in Manhattan at some point, and I had met a very well-known hedge fund manager, and mm-hmm. you know, he had told me, I read everything you write on Seeking Alpha, you know, I think your stuff's fantastic. And this is a guy who's, you know, in the news, right? Like, he's a big guy, he's worth a lot of money, hundreds of millions or whatever, and he's running billions of dollars. And I'm like, you know, this guy who just quit his bartending job 6 months ago or whatever, and, you know, I have this guy telling me, like, yeah, you know, I get an email alert every time you write something. Like, I love it, you know, and discussing things with me that I've written. Well, what do you think about this? You know, well, here's what I'm thinking, you know, and I'm just like, holy shit. Like, number one, like, this is crazy that I'm even talking to this guy about this, because I don't really have any financial analysis background, number one. But I remember calling you that day. Do you remember that?
I do.
Do you remember what I said? Do you remember that phone call? I had a couple of whiskeys.
I remember you saying something along the lines of, why the hell is name redacted? Why the hell does he care what I think? I can't believe you guys just gave me a chance to have this conversation.
Yeah, it was something like that. I was at Penn Station. I had a few whiskeys, and I was probably gushing a little bit, but I had to pick up the phone and call you and just say, like, look, man, the site is so powerful, the platform is so powerful, that this stuff that I'm writing from my apartment in Germantown is landing on the desk of, you know, this guy who is, you know, worth hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever. And I was just like, holy shit. And then, you know, then you start to realize how valuable the site is. And you know, that speaks to the job that you guys have done in developing it and keeping it reputable, keeping it credible. One of the things I love about the site that I'm always telling you is it's not fucking hideous to look at. Like, not to talk shit on the street, but like, you go on the street's website and it's just, I don't know how it is now, but I remember it used to be, or like, you go on Motley Fool and, you know, you go to pull up an article and it's just fucking advertisement after advertisement. You know, you have like a 1-inch column of content that runs down the middle of the screen, and there's pop-up ads, and there's ads for, you know, hemorrhoid cream, and there's shit that pops up, you know, what is Warren Buffett buying today? It's like, who gives a fuck? I'm just trying to read this article about JCPenney or whatever stock I'm losing money on. And Seeking Alpha has always looked really clean and really nice, and it's an easy site to navigate, but the advertisements are there. You just have to, you know, you have to look for them. You don't notice them immediately. You notice the content immediately. I think you guys have done a really beautiful job with that.
I got to give credit real credit to our media team, because one of the things we've done, and, you know, in order to fully engage with the site, you have to register, which, you know, we get a lot of, you know, go screw yourselves over that one too. Why do I need to register to do stuff? You guys suck. I don't even know who you are. But, you know, by getting that registration, we've been able to build a more powerful model for our advertising clients that gives them insight. And Catherine Divney, our head of sales, is just really good at taking the long-term view to getting ads, to getting high-quality advertisers on the site who understand working within our framework. And, you know, the easy road is always to say, hey, let's put an ad in the middle of an article because then everybody's going to see it.
Right.
And I understand that model. Like, you know, revenue has to come from somewhere. And believe me, I've always been a fan of revenue supporting editorial, because, you know, I've never brought a direct dollar of revenue into a company. So I like the people that do that. Back to the kids liking food thing. But they, from the time I joined the company, and particularly, you know, Catherine's been running the show on sales for, you know, the past 3 or 4 years. She's really good at making sure that we get the kind of people in there who get our model and want to work with us.
Yeah. And I think
we can return value to them because we can give them, make sure that they're getting in front of the right people.
And as a reader of the site too, or somebody at least that's consistently on the site, I'm far more likely now, you know, I probably, with a site like The Street that's going to pop up advertisements, I'm so concerned with closing the pop-up ad or ignoring them because they're so perverse and intrusive on your browsing experience that I'm going to click on an advertisement 0 out of 10,000 times. Even if in the rare instance that it's something that I find interesting, I'm just so turned off by it that I just don't even want to fucking participate because I don't want to offer them positive reinforcement for the way that they're doing things. But if you kind of, like you're saying, take the longer view and you present things in a way that isn't like horribly going to offend all of your senses as soon as you log on, you know, maybe I'll click through one or twice out of every 10,000 visits. And that's when you're doing advertising on the internet, that's what you're looking for, right? You're looking for, you know, people to kind of not immediately be turned off to the ads and, you know, feel comfortable enough with the browsing experience that I know if I click through, like if I go to, you know, The Street and they have an advertisement and I click through to it, like I feel like I know I'm going to get 6 pop-up windows and, you know, 2 will be porn and 2 will be, you know, trying to sell me Crash Proof Retirement Portfolio, that asshole that's always on CNBC. It's a whole other podcast there. I got to talk about that guy. But, yeah. You know, and then 2 will be, you know, win tickets to see Tony Robbins at the Learning Annex, you know. And I feel like, you know, with Seeking Alpha, if I'm going to click through for an ad to TD Ameritrade, I'll probably wind up on TD Ameritrade's site. So anyways, look, man, I know we both got shit to do today. I just have 2 really quick things I wanted to end on. One is I just want to see if you could give me a couple minutes on St. Baldrick's Foundation. I know it's a charity that you're involved with. I see you advocating for it every year. And then I have one final question after that. So just why don't you tell everybody a little bit about that and how they can donate if they're interested.
So yeah, St. Baldrick's, I found out about it back. So my son is now 15. He came home from school in fourth grade. He's like, "Hey, this kid in my class shaved his head for cancer research. I want to do that." And I was like, "Okay, you're 9. You know, sounds like a great thing," but we had missed the event. I said, "You know, find out what he did." He talked to him. He came back. And I said, "Okay, that sounds good. You know, we'll do it next year." If you've ever been around a 9 or 10 year old boy, you know that short-term memories or long-term memory actually isn't a strong suit. That next year, shortly after Christmas, like, "Hey, remember we were going to do St. Baldrick's this year?" And so I was like, "Okay, I've got to do my research now." So I looked it up, and St. Baldrick's is just one of the coolest charities I've ever found. They were created shortly after 9/11, I believe. And what they did is a bunch of guys got together, and they wanted to raise money for childhood cancer. And it started as a room of, I think, traders or, you know, financial industry guys in New York started it off. And it has just ballooned because it's a fun event, and, you know, because a bunch of people go into a room and everybody, you know, you get your head shaved. You know, it's the goofiest thing in the world. But so my son and I got it. I looked it up, and then there was a family connection. My wife's oldest sister died of leukemia at 2.5 years old. So that connection was very natural. And the fact that Brendan had found this seemingly by accident that was so relevant for his mom's family was very touching. And so at that point, I was like, "We're in. You know, this is meant to be." So he and I started out that first year, and it's only been he and I. He helps me out, you know, by offering up more hair than I do, if nothing else. And over 6 years, you know, we've averaged about $3,700 a year. We're actually shaving at noon today is this year's event. And we set out with a target of 3,000. And while you and I have been talking, I had my tracker up on a different screen, and we just crossed to 3,300 for this year, which is phenomenal. And it's I won't go through the whole thing, but St. Baldrick's advocates, they support pure research. So they're funding doctors who are trying to identify cures for these diseases. They are a great advocacy organization. They spend, you know, I believe somewhere in the order of 80 to 90% of their money goes toward research.
Right.
Unfortunately for, you know, nonprofits, they have to spend some money on infrastructure. Their number used to be higher, but I think just as they've grown, it's become harder. You know, they've had to invest a little bit more. But this event we're participating in today, I'll just do a quick refresh because the internet's cool like that, has 21 teams participating in shaving and has raised $126,478 out of $125,000 goal for childhood cancer research. And this is, you know, it's a fun way to do something good. And for me, as a parent, the opportunity to participate in an annual thing like this with my son, teach him the value of philanthropy, have something he and I do together, and, you know, just be able to do something. As you know, we've been blessed with 4 healthy kids. There are parents who haven't.
Right.
So it's just, if you want to find out about St. Baldrick's, just go to stbaldricks.org, stbaldricks.org. And don't worry about donating to my team.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I'm going to try and publish this podcast today, which is St. Patrick's Day. Is it too late to contribute to your team, or can people, how does it work?
You can contribute all year long. you know, the primary fundraising I do is always 1 month ahead of the event. So okay. I started annoying all my friends and followers on social media on February 17th. And after today, I'll post a closer, but you can keep contributing. It's, if you want to look to our team, particularly at stbaldricks.org, Moriarty's of New Hope. but, you know, give to the organization. It's not, I've never been about, you know, being the team with the most money or whatever. Investigate the organization, evaluate it, and if it fits with your charitable giving model, throw them a couple bucks because they do good work.
And you have it, you have a link to your team on your Twitter account, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So when I post the podcast, I'll put up your Twitter account. What's your Twitter handle anyways, just so people know?
At Geo Moriarty. G-E-O Moriarty.
Okay, cool. All right, man. So listen, my final question is, you know, being an Irishman from Boston, and given that it is St. Patrick's Day, what's the drink du jour for a man like George Moriarty on a day like today?
I'm a man who favors the classics. There will be...
Tequila sunrise. Naturally.
A nice Manhattan. Guinness all the way.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I don't know why it took you for a whiskey drinker, though.
I enjoy my whiskey. But, you know, first off, as a proud Irishman, St. Patrick's Day is amateur hour.
Right.
So, you know, you got to be able to be prepared to deal with the rookies. But also, it's a marathon, not a sprint, and you can't drink whiskey all day long.
Right. When you do drink whiskey, what do you drink? I've actually had conversations with you on the phone where you've told me you're drinking whiskey, which, yes, by the way, I encourage. I just...
Yeah, that's always in the evening when that's happened. evenings somewhere.
Sure. 9 a.m. on a Tuesday.
Irish whiskeys, I favor Tullamore Dew and Redbreast, but Jameson's is always reliable.
Redbreast.
As well as Bushmills.
Pot-stilled whiskey. Jameson, right, is a favorite of mine and a family favorite as well. Have you ever had, just speaking of the authentic Irish experience, have you, and yeah, St. Patrick's Day is amateur hour, having worked in an Irish pub in downtown Philadelphia for 5 years and having to do St. Patrick's Day. And not only that, but the days preceding it, and it actually starts like the weekend preceding it. They do this thing called the Erin Express in Philly. They bus people around. It's a bunch of Penn students that can't hold their liquor, basically. It's some fucking travesty. But have you ever had O'Hara's Stout?
O'Hara's Stout, I have not.
So, have you ever had Beamish?
That one I may have, I'm not sure.
So they're both stouts. They're often both on nitrogen, just like Guinness.
Okay.
O'Hara's is a family-owned brewery from County Cork, Ireland. And I'll tell you a quick story. The bar that I used to work at in Philadelphia stopped carrying Guinness some years back, like 20 or 25 years back, because Guinness was it was an authentic Irish pub. It was established in 1860. The name of the bar was McGillan's. It was founded by the McGillan family in 1860, William McGillan and his wife, and they raised their children upstairs at the bar. So it was true Irish immigrant founded bar, and it's the oldest continually operating Irish pub in Philadelphia. So it's been open for more than 150 years nonstop, even through Prohibition. They had a little secret thing that they did.
Shocking.
So, right. So at some point, probably like in the 90s, Guinness came to Philadelphia and started to help Irish pubs open. And they were kind of like these cookie cutter Irish pubs, like Fado on, you know, 15th and Locust is one of them, where they have a model that they follow. They have a design. They have, there's tons of Guinness advertising stuff that's always put around. And the deal was Guinness would help you open the bar if you served Guinness and you served, you know, whatever other brands that they were affiliated with. And so all these little like cookie cutter kind of Irish pubs started to open up. I think Tiernanog was another one in Philly. Con Murphy's maybe. I don't even know if they're still open. But the guy that owned McGillan's told Guinness, you know, if you're going to help all these people open up, we want to have the same pricing as they're getting, because they were getting a discount on Guinness. And we want all the perks and benefits. We've been here for 100 years already. We're a real authentic Irish pub. And Guinness gave them a bunch of shit. And to this guy's credit, you know, he told Guinness to go fuck themselves. He was like, you know what? Take a walk. And so this pub that I worked at in Philly didn't carry Guinness. It didn't carry Bass. It didn't carry Killian's. It didn't get all these,
you
know.
That's the most Irish story ever.
Isn't it? So instead, what they did was they went out and they looked for authentic stouts from Ireland that, because at this point Guinness is being made in Mexico, it's being made in Canada, you know, it's not, this is not an Irish guy out in the countryside producing beer. It's mass produced. There's guys with lab coats and turkey basters and petri dishes. So one of the beers that they started to carry some years back was called O'Hara's Irish Stout. And the brewmaster, this little Irish guy, Seamus O'Hara, they flew him over from County Cork in Ireland, and he came and spent a couple of days and drank 50 beers a day with us at the bar. And just a plug for his brewery, man. Fantastic, beautiful Irish stout. If you ever see it somewhere, it's always on nitrogen, like Guinness. So it's the same style of beer, but it's a beautiful, beautiful beer. So that's my drink recommendation for the day would be.
I like it. I'll keep an eye out for it, because after we shave, I'm taking the kids to a local...
To get drunk?
No. Any authorities listening, my children will not be drinking today. Because the cops are all tuning in to the QTR podcast.
Oh, yeah. I have a very diverse listener base. You could be receiving dozens of Twitter hits after this podcast. Dozens. Anyways.
Hundreds.
Right.
I appreciate it, man. This was great.
It's been real, George. Thank you so much, brother. And we'll talk again soon, all right?
Absolutely. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.